Blog Talk Radio. Okay, folks, it is another edition of Imperium Europa. This is your host, Dana Antiochus. I just faded out the song there that was Falkenbach with the song called Jaller, G-J-A-L-L-A-R, and they are another example of, I guess you could call, Viking folkish metal out there in Scandinavia. I'm sure they're either Swedish or Norwegian, but I could be wrong. But we got a great treat for you guys tonight, as I've been promising for a while now. I got Robert Taylor on the line. Hopefully he's on the line here. There is a caller, and I'm hoping that's him. Let me just bring him up and see if that is indeed him. Hello, Robert, is that you? Oh, okay. Is this Damon?
Yes, Damon.
Okay, let me just put you on mute. I'm going to wait for my guest to call in. And if he doesn't, I've got some things prepared just in case. But we spoke, we had a back and forth on Facebook. And, you know, I'm expecting him to call in at any time. And the number is 347-633-9657. And hopefully we can move on from there. Okay, well, how you doing, Damon? Well, I got you on. I guess we could kill a little time before Robert comes on. Well, actually, I was gonna give an introduction for my guest, but I want to make sure he's with us before I do that. So I guess I'll just have a little, you know, shoot the shit with you. How you doing, man? What's up with you? Anything new?
I haven't heard of your guest before, so. Is he famous into the white scene or something?
Well, I mean, I don't know what you would call famous, but he definitely is a longtime activist. And, you know, he's from the older generation. He wasn't, I'm pretty sure, he was in a group called the Minutemen. And they were like a pre-militia movement that existed in the 60s. You know, this was during that tumultuous time of change in the United States when everything was kind of converging at once on us. And, you know, you had a cultural Marxist taking over and this kind of thing. So that was a group that was part of the backlash to that. So, I heard him. He did a couple interviews. I don't know. He did one with Keith Preston on attackthesystem.com. You can find that by just going to attackthesystem.com and then click on podcasts and scroll down to the November 11th, 2012 interview. And, that's there for anybody to see. I think he might have also done one with Robert Stark. I'm not sure. He was a very good speaker. He had a lot of experience, life experience, and just the movement, I guess you could call it, of opposing the United States government and all its policies, and you know, trying to awaken the people, the masses. I think he had a transformation. And then he became more of a racialist-minded thinker, and also in spirituality. That was the other major reason I wanted to bring him up was because he, I think he's an Odinist, I'm pretty sure, or he follows folkish, Volkish religion. So, I wanted to get a taste of what he had to say about that. So hopefully he calls, and if not, you know, I apologize. I mean, we put these things together. I had, I confirmed them last week, but, you know, that's the nature of this kind of thing. You never know what's going to happen. And if worst case scenario, I have a number of readings to get to. But, what's going on your end, Damon? Are you seeing any signs of hope?
Not really, actually.
Yeah,
the Mythman, that sounds like a militia, I guess.
Yeah, well, they, Yeah, they had like just caches of weaponry and guns. Even to this day, they're still finding caches. They had like a formidable force of thousands of people at one time. So that's why it's kind of an inspirational sign that something can catch fire. And this was at a time that it was definitely needed. It wasn't. And I wouldn't even I that's why I really hope he calls, because I don't want to really be talking about it too much, because he's the guy that lived the lifestyle, and nobody could say it better than him. But this was a pretty formidable group. So
Yeah,
I was over. What were you gonna say? Go ahead, sorry.
that's definitely a thing of the past since, the mid-90s with the whole Waco thing and stuff. They made sure people are afraid to be a part of any militia these days.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's why that's why D.B. Campbell even posits that Oklahoma City was a false flag operation. I don't know if I buy into that, but it certainly had that effect on dampening the movement and just completely snuffing it out, because nobody wanted to be associated with the militia movement after the Murray Building was bombed, which kind of says a lot about all these people that I call them weekend warriors, that kind of put the camouflage on, and they play war games, and but if something actually happens, they run away. I mean, it's so, and a lot of them are caught up in just this patriotard kind of mentality of the Constitution and Americana, American history and Christianity and all this kind of stuff. So it's just it's too bad. But it was a good thing while it lasted. I guess it was a way to show that Americans are pissed off. And if all this Tea Party stuff was focused in a better direction, then maybe we could have a resurgence or something like that. But I got people trying to talk to me right now. I'm trying to do my show. But anyhow, yeah, I'm not seeing it, so I don't know. I hope he doesn't let us down. If maybe maybe something happened, you never know. But yeah, when I was over at reasonradionetwork.com trying to research his past interviews, because I wanted to find if he had done one with Robert Stark in addition to Keith Preston. I found a lot of really great articles. Apparently they, this website, reasonradionetwork.com, I always promote it, even though it's defunct now and nothing goes on. Have you ever been there, Damon? Have you checked that out ever? Tom Sunnick was on there. You had Robert Stark. You had European American Hour, the Fighting Side with me, with fellow in Canada, and Mark Weber reports. There was just a whole bunch of talent all in one spot, and it was a great network, but very political, very highbrow. I really I love the fact that we have Renegade here to provide an alternative for all the networks out there that are trying to carry on this message, but they do it in other ways. We have a kind of a uniqueness to us. But yeah, I bring it up because I ran into a couple articles. I guess I'll get into that one right now, because it was pretty pertinent to what's going on. And I guess this came off of, at the bottom I'm looking and it says the Occidental Quarterly, so I guess that must have been the source. And the guy that wrote it was Douglas Owen, and he's written a number of works on racial topics that have appeared in Wilmot Robertson's Instauration magazine that was in the 80s. And Wilmot Robertson, he was another pretty big figure that kind of, I don't know if he knew Dr. Pierce, but I would compare him to Dr. Pierce in a way. I have a book called Ventilations, which is he wrote the book The Dispossessed Majority. I would recommend everybody looking that one up. And you know, it was he's just another warrior, intellectual warrior for the cause. And I guess I'll just get into this right here, and we'll see what you think. Maybe I can bounce it off of you. It's called Why We Can't Wait, and this is by Douglas Olson. From April 27th, 2009, and it's kind of an analysis of the movement, or the lack of movement, rather. So he writes that as much as Wilmot Robertson, as much as what he did for the white survival movement, and his work was impressive and considerable, his one major mistake was insisting that, quote, nothing could be done by whites to take back their civilization until an unspecified period of education made conditions right for action. He launched a magazine, Instauration, in 1975 to help in that education effort. And, you know, aside from this nothing can be done argument, as a side note, you know, just a little commentary, we often also hear that nothing really can be done until there's a collapse, until this whole thing just implodes. And that may or may not be correct, but you know, I don't believe that that's the mentality that we should have. But I'll continue on. He says, sad to say, by the middle 19, and this cuts perfectly into my guest, if he appears, because you know, he was a man of action that really did something. So and he, you know, he's an older guy now, older fellow now, but he was out there when other people weren't. So I'll go on. He says, sad to say, by the middle 1970s, most of our leaders, quote-unquote, had already decided to do nothing out of hopelessness, laziness, or sheer cowardice. Robertson was the first of which I am aware to posit a period of inactivity as a strategy toward eventual action of some kind. Today, the do-nothing attitude seems to have infected nearly all reasonable white activist organizations. With the best of our people sitting in self-imposed exile from the public arena, the media are free to paint the foolish and violent actions of the stupidest and most irresponsible among us as the mainstream of the white supremacy, quote-unquote, movement, scaring away any potential recruits whose hearts are in the right place, but do not want to be associated with lunatics and criminals. You know, and this is why Dr. McDonald always talks about the pathological image that our movement gets, the idea that if you are for survival of your people, of the white race, then you are some kind of idiot or insane, demented, deranged criminal. You know, that's basically what they portray. So, all right. Our refusal to act, and then of course it doesn't help when we do have people or individuals or groups that really do make us look stupid, and you know, they make it so that they push away the good, you know, and that's why organizations should not have a kind of take all who come approach. Elitism should be the order of the day, you know, for anybody, because quality is always going to be better than quantity, and apparently it's hard to get either, you know, today. But I'll just go on and finish this, and then we'll talk a little more. Let me see. Our refusal to act publicly in a reasoned and nonviolent way must certainly keep many talented and sincere people from ever finding us and joining our virtually immobile movement. The unchallenged straw man of violent white supremacy, quote unquote, is also a godsend for the enemy's fundraising efforts, and appears to justify the endless agitation for increased repression, not just of white action, but of our history, our speech, and our very ideas. All of this, of course, makes it ever less likely that Robertson's day of deliverance will someday arrive. One can only laugh at the thought of Lenin, Mao, Hitler, Mussolini, even Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, and leaders of the more recent homosexual and handicapped revolutions urging their followers to sit around and twiddle their thumbs until some celestial alarm clock informs the official astrologers that the time is right for a revolt. guaranteed to be both painless and unstoppable. Yet that is precisely where most of us sit year after year, while our race's plight becomes more and more desperate and our options fewer and more bleak. In the same way, many responsible couples will postpone having children for a decade or more until their careers are on track, their finances are in place, and the time is right, quote unquote. Yes, this is responsible behavior, but it forfeits their ability to have numerous offspring before age makes that a prohibitively dangerous or impossible prospect. Too often, such couples grow to enjoy their solitude or the indulgences they can afford on their own, and they eventually decide not to be inconvenienced by children or feel that they are too old to take on such a challenge. Look at the other side, at the teeming masses of non-whites spewing forth progeny while they themselves are still children. Yes, it is irresponsible behavior. They cannot possibly feed, clothe, shelter, and nurture these children. But so what? Which side is winning? The responsible or the irresponsible? Where does the future lie? With a relative handful of high-quality whites, or with the overwhelming masses of low-quality non-whites? Which side is supporting the other through confiscatory taxation? Which side is so weak that it cannot even effectively protest, much less stop, a massive alien invasion of its own homeland? Ask yourself, what would possibly constitute a right time for action? When Negroes began agitating for equal rights in the 1950s, the South was rigidly segregated, and virtually all of its federal, state, and local politicians were fervently dedicated to upholding that policy. Through their legendary political longevity, Southern members of Congress controlled most key committees and wielded incredible power. Was that the right time to begin a fight for civil rights? When homosexuals held their first demonstration for equal rights in 1965, same-sex sodomy was illegal in every state, and virtually every social, political, cultural, governmental, religious, and business institution considered them anathema. Could that possibly have been the right time to demand equality? How could 1776, when the British Empire ruled not only the seas, but a huge portion of the entire globe, have been the right time for a small band of upstart colonists to challenge the mighty John Bull? Face it, now is always the right time for assertion of our group and individual rights. As Klansman Daniel Carver used to observe on the Howard Stern radio show, if we're going to have a race war, we need to get on with it while whites still have a chance to win. By sitting on our hands for the past four decades, we have only made our task infinitely harder. Instead of standing up on our hind legs then, like men, and stopping the anti-white juggernaut before it became supreme in every aspect of American life, we waited for the right time. That fantasy date when we would somehow be able to just ride up, most likely on a unicorn, and reclaim our lost rights without any resistance, without any cost, without any sacrifice or inconvenience at all. Well, here's a dirty little secret. That day is never, never, never going to come. And, you know, I'm coming to this conclusion myself, actually. You know, it just... The odds that this whole thing is going to come down, as inevitable as it might be, it just seems like it could take decades for that to happen. And, you know, before that does happen, we're going to be wiped out. So, you know, something, I think our weight should be put behind, pan-secessionism, which is another reason why I kind of enjoy Keith Preston's articles, because he kind of, he promotes that type of thing, so... Okay. With literally every hour that passes, our numbers are smaller, our prospects are dimmer, our rights are fewer, and our chances of survival, let alone a return to power, move closer to absolute zero. Remember that tired old cliche about the Holocaust? When they came for the Jews, I didn't protest because I wasn't a Jew. Well, when they raised our taxes to pay for legions of new black and brown parasites, we didn't protest because it would have been selfish. When they made white males second-class citizens by giving special protected status to every other group, we didn't protest because it would have been intolerant. When they excluded our children from colleges and jobs for being white, we didn't protest because would have been racist. And, you know, David Duke has been pounding away, bringing to light the total Jewish nepotism at the Ivy League universities. I recommend everyone go and listen to his shows on the Rents Network. You know, he's he's got that guy, Patrick Slattery. I'd like to have him on my show sometime. He seems like a pretty educated, intelligent guy. And, you know, they really show, using a Jewish researcher, I think, who brought this to the forefront, that the overpopulation, the disproportionate representation of Jewish applicants that are received in these high-level elite institutions that make, you know, these people go on to be very powerful people. And, you know, when you compare the white-Gentile achievement gap, you know, they are outsmarting the Jews, and yet they are so underrepresented at these institutions. So that definitely is true. Okay, I'll just keep going with this. When they facilitated a massive third world invasion of the United States, we didn't protest because it would have been xenophobic. When they criminalized words, attitudes, and even thoughts, we didn't protest because by then we were just too damn scared. The tragedy is that they are really us, white male politicians steered by our racial and ethnic enemies. Politicians we could have cajoled and coerced into seeing things our way. When they started betraying us, we could have punished them, replaced them with our own stalwarts, and gotten things back on track. But we didn't. We waited for someone else to do it, and nobody did. We waited for it to be easy and only made it harder. Once more, now is always the right time for assertion of our group and individual rights. Now, he closes with a phrase of Jared Taylor. I'm not even going to bother reading the rest of it, but, you know, Jared Taylor of American Renaissance. And we have our bones to pick with him because he focuses just on the race issue without bringing up the Jewish problem, which, in my opinion, is kind of pointless because, as one of my callers mentioned, you know, I think it was Andrew, you know, the racial issues and the race problem here just doesn't make any sense without understanding the Jews in the middle, in between, you know, riling everything up and, you know, acting on behalf of the non-white races to use them as a proxy force against white people. So, you know, that is our little bone to pick. However, you know, he's still doing good work by just trying to raise awareness to, you know, racial issues. And he's got his organization, American Renaissance. So, you know, I can't really complain. I mean, we should really have thousands of more organizations like that. You know, we just need we kind of are, like I said, we're elitist, and we kind of try to, you know, look for people who encompass all the aspects of this struggle, not just one. But what did you think of that, Damon? It appears I don't have any other callers on the line. I'm going to try and give him a message and see
if he... Yeah, Robert Taylor must be in a different time zone.
Yeah, well, he told me he's on Eastern... He told me he's on Eastern Standard, so... You know, I'm hoping that's not the issue. Yeah, it says I'm on Eastern Standard Time, so you know, this is it's 8:30 here, and I'm in CT, a very liberal state. But yeah, I mean, I had a real long back and forth with the guy, and on Facebook, and we really went in deeply to this whole movement, and you know, trying to discuss well, we talked about National Socialism and how an openly National Socialist outfit really probably wouldn't work here in the United States. I basically say, look, you can be a National Socialist right down the line, 100% ideologically, but just don't take their symbols and use their stuff when trying to communicate the message to Americans, because they're never gonna, you know, they're too brainwashed. I don't know. What do you think about that, Damon? I mean, you think it works to just go around and goose step in uniforms, or Is it better to wear a suit and tie?
Yeah, probably just a suit and tie, you know, casual dress, business dress, probably. I mean, you know, if not, then, you know, more, you know, casual blue collar would work better than looking like soldiers. You know, especially when you only have a few people. Kind of looks ridiculous.
Yeah,
I think one thing we could probably learn from Robert Taylor when he finally gets on is, you know, that organizations are a thing of the past, and, you know, we could see where it did not work out and why it did not work out. Probably is the most beneficial thing from something like this.
Yeah, well, I mean, what are you saying? Are you, like, a fan of leaderless resistance and, you know, just the lone wolf philosophy of Tom Metzger? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I'm a fan of that, but I say, you know, while we're not living, you know, we have this inverted totalitarianism or soft kind of Bolshevism right now. But it isn't hard. I mean, you know, it's not really – I don't really fear the U.S. government. I don't really fear you know, I mean, sure, they are cracking down on, you know, anything related to terrorism or anything like that. But, you know, really, we still do have our rights relatively. And, you know, it's I think it would be a shame not to – because with the lone wolf thing, you know, it's just you can only have cells of people, and they're never – you can never amass any kind of, you know, pressure to put on to the government for or to even try to form your own community. You know, you can't do it with just a couple people. You got to have numbers. And James Mason, you know, in Siege, the book Siege, recommended that don't ever go out if you don't have enough of a force. You know, because then it looks stupid when the cops are protecting you. But yeah, what now, when you said you just picked up Robert Taylor and he's in a different time zone, I mean, are you sure you got the right guy? Like, how did you find him?
I don't know the guy at all. I was just taking a guess, and like, I was thinking, well, maybe he'll come on in about a half hour at 9, you know, if he's on a different time zone, then he'll think
I don't know what I could do in the meantime. I mean, he We had some long conversations on Facebook, but I wouldn't want, you know, if they're private, I wouldn't want to let them out. But it's nothing private. The information isn't private. It's all just regular ideological kind of talk. And he strikes me as the kind of guy that is just honest. I mean, you know, he doesn't really he'd come on here and just tell me exactly like it is. So. But I don't know. I wouldn't want to. We had a long talk about just communism and national socialism in America and the history, you know, and just how we're from really a whole different mindset, you know, and that's part of the problem. That's why it was so easy for them to create this individualism modality of, you know, this Ayn Rand, you know, kind of bullshit libertarianism, because it kind of goes with the history of the United States. And we're not into discipline. We're not into, you know, formations and, you know, marching and goose stepping and this kind of thing, you know, whereas you had that tradition back in Germany at that time, you know. So aside from the fact that the country is just not homogenous, you also have the history of historical rebellion and anti-state attitudes. Now, we all hate the state, obviously. I mean, the state is the enemy, you know, and Keith Preston is not a national socialist, but his website, Attack the System, targets the state, the common enemy, ZOG, Zionist Occupied Government. So, you know, we can have alliances with people of other ideological or philosophical or political persuasions, provided that we all have this same mutual enemy. And, you know, I just think that the fact that America was born in revolution, born in violence, born in revolt, you know, born in as a colonialist outpost or a secessionist you know, that's something we can play on to try to pull away or withdraw from the system because, you know, let's face it, we're never going to have enough time to, you know, just take American third position or rather American Freedom Party. I'm never going to be, I wish they didn't change that name because I'm never going to be able to go back, you know, because I really like the American third position. But let's just say American Freedom Party, let's just say they managed to win some candidates and some seats in, you know, different states here and there. You know, you still have, you got a Senate, you have the House of Representatives, you have the police, you have, you know, the sheriffs and all these different hierarchies of power. And there's just not enough of us to infiltrate and take this all back, you know, and march into Washington and change the tide. I just think I think we should begin building and creating an infrastructure independent and within kind of in this whole, you know, prepper tradition of, you know, waiting for this apocalypse. Only you're not waiting for the apocalypse or the end of the world or this collapse. You're just trying to build a new, the birth pangs of a new ethno state that will enable our people to survive on this continent. You know, so yeah, what say you?
Yeah, I got a comment on the article you read earlier about time for action now. And, like, yeah, I agree, like, whites are too responsible. And back through the, you know, 60s and 70s, they were telling our parents to only have two kids at the most, you know, so they have a better lifestyle. But that, you know, made room for the Mexican invasion now. So all they did was make an opening, and now they use the excuse that they need a higher population, which I don't see how that's true with unemployment.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, you can't underestimate the, you know, the guilty our own people have. I mean, that's really, I think this is why we're in such a bind, because so many of our own people are just not getting it and are willingly, openly, or subconsciously collaborating with the enemy. You know, somebody posted something here in relation to the article I wrote. This is something on, let's see here, a professor or Dr. Ibisfeld. It's I-E-I-B-L and then hyphen E-I-B-E-S-F-E-L-D-T. I don't know where this guy is. Maybe in Norway, I guess. The article here is EU will have a common asylum system. I don't know if it's related to that, but he writes, if some want to retire from evolution by not breeding, then that's their prerogative. However, they are not entitled to give away / waste reproductive chances of other members of their population. And certainly politicians do not have the right to prescribe a multicultural, multi-ethnic society. Thereby, they fail to fulfill the mandate entrusted to them to represent the interests of their people. If one wants to help, then one has to do it in other ways. For example, that the situation in the countries of origin of immigrants improves politically and economically. A responsible government is also responsible for crisis prevention. Uncontrolled population growth in the developing world will lead to catastrophic conditions in the foreseeable future. If we do not want to be drawn into the vortex of increasing impoverishment, then Europe must foreclose to a certain point. Only if the European Community of Nations is thus obtained, it will continue to be able to live up to their humanitarian ideals and thus to help others. See, I would go a step further and say the Europeans, we have no business, you know, trying to go and help all these other poor countries. I mean, this is ridiculous, and I think this kind of comes from the Christian mindset and the, you know, kind of like the white man's burden. I brought that up before on a previous show, but yeah, I figured I'd read that. Yeah, you know, we are about a little more than half an hour into it, and I'm a little disappointed, but I can't hold it against them. I don't know what happened. You know, I'm going to try to, let's see here. I wanted to kind of see some things that he said just about the movement. You know, I don't know if I had, well, I do recommend everybody go and listen to the Robert Stark interview. He just made a lot of really astute points just about where we stand and Western man's capacity to kind of revert. You know, there is there's this show called The Mountain Men. Have you seen it at all? It's on I don't know if it's on the History Channel or not, but I heard Keith from Truth Militia mentioned it, and you know that was a really great it's a great show because this is another American tradition that we had, and these guys basically were the most rugged survivalists living in conditions that could kill you if you don't know what you're doing. And, you know, they grow these beards and, I mean, they were out there in the 1800s and just weathering, you know, the environment. And, you know, this is another part of America that I guess we can look to as you know, something valuable. You know, Manifest Destiny is another thing kind of related to this, the opening of the American West. And you know, we really took that land, we took it from you know, the Indians in a fight, and we were the stronger power. And this was at a time when, see, all these immigrants, they came over to the United States from Europe because Europe had kind of just a stagnation problem and an overpopulation problem. And they were, you know, yearning to breathe fresh air, you know, because over there it was just the cities were very condensed. And, you know, then they find this new land and it has all this open, you know, just open fields and mountains. And, you know, it provided a place for Europeans to have some breathing room and, you know, come and make a brand new life. And, you know, the Constitution, I mean, I have to agree with J.B. Campbell, who says that, you know, the founding fathers were really anti-government in their minds because they had just fought King George, the king, and, you know, they were very anti-authoritarian, you know, and that's why in the modern age, something like a socialist or national socialist government is just hard for Americans to swallow because they've been kind of raised up to be rebels, you know, or to be, you know, it's my way or the highway, or lack of community, lack of building a nation, you know, as a one organic kind of whole. You know, it was everything goes over here. You know, you had different cultures, different areas. In the South, they had their own aristocratic agrarian society. And then in the North, you had the industrial factories and, you know, the all that. And then the West kind of was, you know, the farming and the mountain men and just, you know, living off the land. You know, so this was the evolution of this country. But, you know, it's just, there are many ways to wake people up to, you know, what's going wrong. I mean, there is no one bullseye shot. I mean, you can bring up 9/11. If the person is, like, into conspiracies, you can bring up, if you are a patriot and you believe in this country, you know, and you really hold on to, you know, this reactionary kind of mindset, you can use the U.S. as liberty. That's a great one to bring up because, of course, just last week, June 6th, is the anniversary of that, when the Israelis purposely bombed our American ship that was defenseless, and you know, so that's another whole thing. You can look up Phil Turney, and you can look up just that whole story. And you know, lastly, I guess another big thing is the Holocaust, but I don't really focus too much on that. You know, there's Yeah, the Holocaust industry, the Hall of Hoax. I mean, that's but most people just don't care. I mean, and if they do care, they're probably, you know, so brainwashed after all these Hollywood movies that you're not going to get to them. So I kind of want to focus on other methods of positive activism that aren't always running into a trap, because you know, it seems like the enemy throws so many things at us that we're always kind of trying to go on the defensive. And, you know, that's the thing I say about the Jews is that they can keep making up a million lies, you know, 6 million lies. And every time they do this, you know, they'll just make a new one up to counter your rebuttal to it. So you're going to always be kind of running around, you know, with your tail between your legs, instead of going on the offensive, you know. So we're trying to figure out how to go on the offense. And, you know, you get what I'm saying, Damon?
Yeah. What you were saying before, you know, religious people of all kinds, they tend to be really, they enforce discipline on their children. So when they grow up, they're not really able to deal with, you know, the blacks or the Mexicans in society, because their parents aren't bringing them up to be disciplined and, you know, turn the other cheek and stuff. So they're easily intimidated. So that's a problem. And most white people tend to be, as we said before, more responsible. And they really should be responsible and just have kids, you know, that you can't afford. Because, I mean, the system will have to make it work eventually. And that's how the others look at it. They're like, you know, I'll have as many kids as I want, and you'll have to take care of it eventually. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I grew up around my whole life. I mean, I think, you know, growing up in an area where you are a minority has its advantages, because it does serve to train you and get you to think racially, because you see just the different types of people around you and the lack of nurturing that their parents put into them. Because I mean, these schools are animal houses, man. I mean, let me tell you, it's just I hated being in high school, and you know, it was just so cramped. I mean, there was you know, the hallways were just filled with people. There were snots everywhere. I mean, it was just like a germ. I mean, and these people all carried germs. And, you know, it was just like, you know, it was a bad scene. But, I mean, it did make me kind of into what I am today. And, you know, aside from being raised and kind of seeing these things myself. But, you know, I mean, it's on the East Coast, you have certain cities that are very minority, and then on the West Coast you have California is you know, basically gone, Texas and New Mexico and these other areas. I think we should really try to start focusing on states that are still a majority, you know, white. I mean, that would be a good starting point, and just try to put a line in the sand or a flag or something and just say, all right, that's it. Enough, you know, no more. We're breaking off from the union, and, you know, we're going to control our own immigration policy over here. But, you know, cause there still is, I mean, there's how many millions of people in this country, and you have, you still have tens of millions of whites, you know, but the problem is the birth rate is so low that, we're getting older. You know, we're getting older. We're not having, I mean, when you see, I see these moms, you know, a lot of them are like Puerto Rican and this kind of thing. And they have like 7, 8 kids, you know, from different fathers. And it's, you know, literally the babies are just falling out of the carriages. I mean, it's like, it's just a madhouse. And then they all go to public school and they get their free lunch and they're free this and they're free that. And, you know, it's, you know, this is the problem. I mean, we would need to control these people, we would need a government that is socialist, but like right-wing socialist, you know, eugenic socialist. I mean, not this liberal cultural Marxist socialism that we have today, where it's the reverse of eugenics. It's dysgenics. They promote or they encourage the unfit to have as many babies as possible, and the fit are the ones that have to pick up the tab for it through taxes. And that's what in the article he meant by confiscation, through taxes. It doesn't look good, that's for sure. But, now you see this kind of thing too, because you live, you're in Indianapolis, and, I guess every city, where are the white cities? I wonder what cities are still, I was in Denver, and that wasn't too bad. It was pretty clean over there. The streets were really clean. And, I don't know. How is Indianapolis while I got you on? And if anybody wants to call in, the number is 347-633-9657. We're 1 hour into it. I'm sorry. My guest has not appeared yet, but he might. So we'll just keep our fingers crossed. I have some songs I put in here. Damon, aside from that Indianapolis question, what did you think of Falkenbach? Did you like that opening track?
Yeah, it's instrumental. That's pretty nice. I have a lot of stuff like that. It's just instrumental, and that's one of my favorite stuff, actually, because, there's not too many talented vocalists, in the lesser-known bands, it seems. Indianapolis.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. No, go ahead.
Yeah, about Indianapolis, I don't know. I mean, it's a religious state. It's still in the, Bible Belt, I guess, even though it's pretty far north and east as well. But, you got at least one church on every street corner here, and you got the whites going around with their adopted little niglet, or maybe it's from their their kid, and their relationship with a black or something. I mean, who knows? They're always walking around with stuff like that. It's got the problems of the larger cities, just on a smaller microcosm. Since there's only about like 1.5 million people in this city versus, cities that got 4 or 5 times as many people. But, it's got the same issues here.
Yeah, and you brought up when I brought up the thing about the band Falkenbach, I found that song to be really epic. It had that epic feel to it. And, this thing with the music is again, it's so important, because I was just thinking about how culture is transmitted through music. And, these bands, these metal bands, these are Aryan culture creators, and this is suppressed Aryan art. If you turn on the radio today, you don't even have to like metal per se to understand what I'm saying. When you turn on the radio, it's just garbage, man. It's just crap. It's all this mediocre. It all sounds the same. It's packaged, plastic, just crap. It all really kind of goes toward, the lowest common denominator, and they try to, I don't know why they do this, but it seems like there is a real suppression of our art, created by our people coming from our racial soul. I remember listening to the rock station, and somebody called in and requested a band called Obituary, and they were a thrash metal band, thrash death metal. I don't know, you probably have heard of them. And the guy was like making fun of it and saying, no, we don't play that out here, it seems like our people are starving for these musical forms that hit somewhere in their soul. There really is something for everybody, because you have fast, thrash music, and then you have like slower, more kind of melancholy doom metal is a genre I'm really into because it has a lot of clean vocal, a lot of female vocals. It's kind of ethereal and it has this like ambient quality goth to stuff like that. So I was just introducing Kyle to My Dying Bride. They're a band out of England. England, of course, is a very rainy, dreary island. So, but since we're about an hour into it, I started with the Falkenbach. I did. I have another band here that I think is just amazing, and they have clean vocals along with the black metal vocals, but. It's a band called In the Woods. Very, very pagan, nature-loving band that is, I would put right up there as elite, or avant-garde. You know, they have kind of psychedelic, roots, or they have, just a progressive psychedelic, combination with the metal. Very melodic and also hypnotic sounds, but the guy's voice, and the lyrics are just are great. They cut to the soul, and they describe, all the lyrics are about basically the rape of our gods, and the taking of a nature-based religion that was born from the blood of our people. And then forcing this alien religion on us, and they touch on that. And they also just touch on the mythos and the all the different aspects of what the religion entailed, the different mystery schools and this kind of thing. And, it is such a big topic, but the music is really an important part of it. Volkish music. And Robert Taylor, I guess, had his own band. I don't know if it was called Change or what. But, I think I'm going to play In the Woods while I have got you on, and maybe we could have a discussion and see, if this, does anything for you, because, the mystical quality to the music kind of really, drew me in and put this band above just all the other ones that sound, kind of similar. So I'm going to play that now, and then we'll be back. The guest call in line is 347-633-9657, and we will be back with you. So here is In the Woods, and the track is called Heart of Ages. Let me get this for you. Okay. All right, we'll be back for you. We'll be back with you. It's 8 minutes, and see you in a bit. Okay, guys, we are back, and looks like Damon's calling back in. All right, the guest call in line is 347-633-9657. And, yeah, I got into a another long argument with somebody on Facebook over the nature of National Socialism and Christianity. And, you know, I kind of took it about as far as it could go and didn't seem like the guy was going to concede to any of my points. So I just, we stopped talking. We agreed to disagree and we moved on, you know, and that's kind of what really needs to happen, I guess. Otherwise, we're going to all, you know, stay in our own little circles. But I would like to see something, some points where we can come together on, you know, and that really the major point would have to be just the survival of our people. But I have a really great thing here that I wanted to get to before, and I guess since I have the opportunity now, I'll probably just go with it. This is there's a guy named Kerry Bolton, and he's in New Zealand. He I think he used to run this magazine called The Nexus. It was a radical kind of right, you know, real politic, history, revisionism, esoteric, occult, fascist kind of stuff. Realist publications, I guess, P.O. Box 1627, Paraparaumu Beach. That's a weird name. Wow. Paraumu Beach, New Zealand. P.O. Box 1627. And they have different issues of this. I don't know if this magazine is still around, but, you know, they have an article. This particular article doesn't come from the Nexus. It was taken from that. The actual magazine I'm holding is Fenris Wolf, and I brought that up before because they did a lot of good stuff. They had interviews with Varg Vikernes and Richard Scutari over at in jail, but he was a member of the Order, and, you know, David Lane published some stuff in there, but, yeah, I mean, it was part of this White Order of Thul group that existed, and they were a combination of Satanism and occult esoteric National Socialism, but, yeah, I figured I'd bring this up to kind of read this. And, of course, a lot of the Christians will say, well, you know, that's not, that's, you know, they just, they say, what are your references, you know? And then they'll say, okay, well, it's not, the reference isn't true, you know, or something like that. But I think that I go by a convergence of evidence, it's called. And when you have all these different things together, that's where you get your data from to basically show that it's the attitude that National Socialism had was that it wanted to replace Christianity. And that's why it had such an appeal, because it had a spiritual message to it of embracing the Nietzschean will to power and to create a higher man, the Ubermensch. But yeah, I'll read right here. I'll start it off. The place of Christianity under Nazism has been a matter of contention, as well as with all else connected with that philosophy. Hitler has been damned as the devil incarnate by his Christian opponents and heralded as a Jesus-like Messiah by his Christian proponents. Opponents versus proponents, yes. The 24th point of the NSDAP's political program even describes National Socialism as standing for positive Christianity. In order to access the real relationship of Christianity to National Socialism, it is necessary to go beyond the propaganda of both pro- and anti-Nazi Christians. To do this, the private pronouncements of the Nazi leaders receive greater attention than their public statements. And that's really important, because I always tell people that you can't go by, you know, public pronouncements that are, you know, made for the record, as opposed to how they really felt. An additional consideration is the actual practice of the Nazi regime towards the churches. Hitler's private conversations with his inner circle between 1941 and 1944, as recorded by Reichleiter Bormann, himself one of the Nazi Party's most avid anti-Christians, as well as we shall see, provide the most insightful of sources in determining the real attitudes of Hitler towards Christianity. Hitler commented of Minister of Religion Kerrl's, K-E-R-R-L, his effort to identify Nazism with positive Christianity, that it was, quote, the noblest of intentions, but I don't believe the thing's possible, and I see the obstacle in Christianity itself. As for the men close to me, quote, he said, who, like me, have escaped from the clutches of dogma, I have no reason to fear that the church will get its hands on them. We'll see to it that the church cannot spread abroad teachings that conflict with the interests of the state. We shall continue to preach the doctrine of National Socialism, and the young will no longer be taught anything but the truth. In the long run, National Socialism and religion will no longer be able to exist together. The ideal solution would be to leave the religions to devour themselves without persecutions. The dogma of Christianity gets worn away before the advances of science. Religion has to make more and more concessions. Gradually, the myths crumble. Okay, here's the early view. During the first years of the regime, and just prior to it, Hermann Rauschning recorded Hitler's conversations with his inner circle. According to Rauschning, a conservative in the ranks of the Nazi Party, who became the president of Danzig, Hitler said of Christianity, quote, leave the hair splitting to others, whether it's the Old Testament or the New, or simply the sayings of Jesus, it's all the same old Jewish swindle. It will not make us free. A German church, a German Christianity, is a distortion. One is either a German or a Christian. You cannot be both. We don't want people to keep one eye on the hereafter. We need free men who know that God is in themselves. Hitler made it clear that he was not interested in an Aryanized Christianity or the Aryan Jesus myth promoted by Houston Stuart Chamberlain, von Liebenfels, and certain party members. You cannot make an Aryan out of Jesus. That's nonsense, he stated. Rather, the festivals of the church, hijacked by Christianity from the heathens in the first place, would be re-heathenized. Quote, Easter is no longer resurrection, but the eternal renewal of our people. Christmas is the birth of our Savior, the spirit of heroism and the freedom of our people. If the priests put up resistance and the regime would expose them before the people, quote, we shall brand them as ordinary criminals. I shall tear the mask of honesty off their faces. And if that is not enough, I shall make them appear ridiculous and contemptible. I shall order films to be made about them. We shall show the history of the monks on the cinema. Indeed, in 1937, a trial was held of 337 monks for, quote, for abusing pupils or patients, committed to their care. A few monks escaped with millions of marks of German money, while the vast majority were imprisoned. The English ex-monk Joseph McCabe commented that they went to court on the vilest of charges of a chaplain named Father Leo Givel. He said, quote, I'm just going to skip this. Let's go to folk religion. A folk religion would arise that would replace Christianity. Quote, the peasant will be told what the church has destroyed for him. The whole of the secret knowledge of nature, of the divine, the shapeless, the demonic. The peasant shall learn to hate the church on that basis. Gradually he shall be taught by what wiles the soul of the German people has been raped. We shall wash off the Christian veneer and bring out a religion peculiar to our race. And this is where we must begin, not in the big cities. Rauschning remarks in his Hitler Speaks that the old folks' customs were being used by the regime to de-Christianize the peasantry. Agriculture Minister Walter Dahre, the original proponent of the famous blood and soil doctrine and the real father of the Green Movement, was one of the regime's most avid anti-Christians. Agricultural exhibitions and themes had themes of the old peasant revolts against the church. Peasant calendars were produced, which replaced Christian festivals with Germanic heathen ones. Now he has communism and Christianity, revolts against nature. The very doctrines of National Socialism and Christianity are antithetical. Christianity was held to be the forerunner of Bolshevism, and both were revolts against nature herself, with the Jews to be behind each. Bormann records Hitler as stating, "Christianity is a religion against nature, natural law, a protest against nature." Taken to its logical extreme, Christianity would mean the systematic cultivation of the human failure. Let's see. To hold humanity eternally in a bondage of lies. After all, it was only between the 6th and 8th centuries that Christianity was imposed on our people by princes who had an allegiance or an alliance of interest with the Shavelings. Our people had previously succeeded in living all right without this religion. I have 6 divisions of the SS composed of men absolutely indifferent in matters of religion. It doesn't prevent them going to their deaths with serenity in their souls. And quote, that the fascists were spared a second civil war is due to the fact that the movement succeeded in uniting the Italian nation in spite of the opposition from the church. Further, fascism clearly defined the position as regards what things fell within the sphere of the church and what things fell within the sphere of the state. When the church refused to recognize the law for the formation of the fascist youth organization, the fascists retaliated by ruthlessly breaking up religious procession from Rome to the south of Italy. The result was that within 3 days, the church had come to heel. And, you know, I mean, fascism has this real strong association with Catholicism. You had the Iron Guard movement, you know, in Romania. You had, of course, Mussolini's fascism was a little different. I don't think anything was more, you know, kind of fit Catholic than the Iron Guard. But the Arrow Cross movement of Hungary, I think, is founded on, you know, they use St. Michael the Archangel, I think, as their... or maybe that was the Iron Guard, rather. But, you know, and then Spain, you had Franco. And I'd like to research this and see how strong the association or link between fascism and Catholicism was over there. But I'll go on here. I'll move on here. They talk about the joy of life. The heathen character of National Socialism was contrasted to the otherworldly preoccupation of the church. Hitler states, to deserve, quote, to deserve its place in history, our people must be above all a people of warriors. This implies both privileges and obligations, the obligation of submitting to a most vigorous upbringing and the privilege of the healthy enjoyment of life. If a German soldier is expected to be ready to sacrifice his life with demur, then he is entitled to love freely and without restriction. Free love. Wow, look at that. In life, love and battle go hand in hand, and the inhibited little bourgeoisie must be content with the crumbs which remain. But if the warrior is to be kept fighting trim, he must not be pestered with religious precepts which ordain abstinence of the flesh. A healthy-minded man simply smiles when a saint of the church, like Saint Anthony, bids him eschew the greatest joy that life has to give, and offers him the solace of self-mortification and castigation in its place. Now, here's there's only a little more of this. Actually, there's a lot more, but probably won't read the whole thing. But here is Himmler and the SS. The SS epitomizes the contradistinction between Christianity and the philosophy of the Third Reich. It was a black order in its own right, and Himmler envisaged the creation of an autonomous SS state which would be an example to the world of National Socialism. In 1937, Himmler instructed his chiefs to plan a counterculture to replace Christianity, and it was declared, quote, the age of the final showdown with Christianity had dawned, and one of the objectives of the SS was to provide Germans with the proper ideological foundation to replace it. An SS porcelain factory manufactured pagan cult objects to replace Christian symbols. The summer and winter solstices were revived to replace Christian festivals. There were SS birth and marriage ceremonies of heathen character. The underlying conception behind such ceremonies was the SS perspectives of birth and marriage as aspects of an eternal cycle of life and death. Himmler's right-hand man, Heydrich, Reich security chief, declared of Christianity and heathenism, quote, "Who is there among us who does not, deep in his heart, provided he can still think with his blood, have a profound, strangely haunting sense of shame when walking through the countryside before the panorama, perhaps, of snow-covered alpine mountaintops or in the midst of a somber Westphalian heath, comes across an image of the crucified Jesus? The gods of our ancestors looked different. They were men, and each had a weapon in his hand, symbolizing the attitude to life that is inherent in our race, that of action, that of a man's responsibility to himself. How different the pale crucified one, expressing by his decided look of suffering, humility, and extreme surrender, qualities which contradict the fundamental heroic attitude of our race." Himmler's idea of God was a major influence on SS philosophy. This Gott, and Gott is G-O-T, was spelled with only one T in archaic German to distinguish from the Christian Gott with two T's. At an SS birth ceremony, it was declared, from God, your knowledge, your tasks, your life purpose, all life's perceptions flow. Each who drink from his tankard be witness to the fact that you are Gott united. SS newlyweds were betrothed before the SS wedding altar and presented with a wooden bread dish by Himmler. This bore the carved legend, "Be worthy of the bread of your soil, then your kin will live forever." Himmler, in his 1935 publication, "The SS as an Anti-Bolshevik Battle Organization," rejected atheism and propounded a belief in a God or first principle responsible for cosmic ordering of this whole earth, the entire planet. This is a little, when they copied this thing, it's like a little, it's a little confusing. Let's see if I can find, and the animal world. I think that's where, this continues, but you know what? I will, this is a little, messed up the way they copied it. But so that's that kind of says a lot there. There's more of this, you know. I guess I'll just finish it because I'm there's not that much. They talk about pure Christianity. Pure Christianity, the Christianity of the catacombs, is concerned with translating the Christian doctrine into fact. It leads quite simply to the annihilation of mankind. It is merely wholehearted Bolshevism under a tinsel of metaphysics. The heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity. Bolshevism is Christianity's illegitimate child. The deliberate lie in the matter of religion was introduced into the world by Christianity. Bolshevism practices a lie of the same nature when it claims to bring liberation to mankind. In the ancient world, the relations between men and gods were founded on an instinctive respect. It was a world enlightened by the idea of tolerance. Christianity was the first creed in the world to exterminate its adversaries in the name of love. Its keynote is intolerance. And isn't that the truth? Continuing, the pox of Christianity. Hitler's analysis of Christianity is Nietzschean. Quote, "The reason why the ancient world was so pure, light, and serene was that it knew nothing of the two great scourges, the pox and Christianity. Christianity is a prototype of Bolshevism, the mobilization by the Jews of the masses of slaves with the object of undermining society. Thus, one understands that the healthy elements of the Roman world were proof against the doctrine. Yet Rome, fascist Italy, allows itself today to reproach Bolshevism with having destroyed the churches, as if Christianity itself hadn't behaved in the same way towards the pagan temples." The deplorable Bible, quote, "It is deplorable that the Bible should have been translated into German, and the whole of the German people should have thus become exposed to the whole of this Jewish mumbo-jumbo. As a sane German, one is flabbergasted to think that the German folk could have led themselves to such a pass by Jewish filth and priestly twaddle. And here's something about priests. What a happy inspiration to have kept the clergy out of the party. On March 21st, 1933, at Potsdam, the question was raised, with the church or without the church? I conquered the state despite malediction pronouncement on us by both creeds, Catholic and Protestant. Yeah, and that's something to remember. The Catholic and Protestant churches were some of the biggest opponents of National Socialism. They only really kind of went along with it when they had no choice. And, you know, the party played ball with the Vatican because they knew it still had a power and it couldn't be liquidated, you know, in one fell swoop, and was going to take a little time to weed it out of the psyche of the people. But I'll go on here. On that day, March 21st, 1933, we went to the Tomb of the Kings whilst the others were attending religious services. Suppose that at that period I'd made a pact with the churches. I'd today be sharing the lot of the Duce, Mussolini. By nature, the Duce is a free thinker, but he decided to choose the path of concessions. For my part, in his place, I'd have decided to choose the path of revolution. I'd have entered the Vatican and thrown everybody out. Wow, what a sight that would have been, huh? As with many other matters, Hitler intended postponing a final reckoning with the priests until after the war. Quote, the evil that's gnawing at our vitals is our priests, of both creeds. After the war, I'll take the necessary steps to make the recruiting of priests an extraordinarily difficult. In particular, I'll no longer allow children from the age of 10 upward to devote their lives to the church when they've absolutely no notion what they're undertaking, in accepting celibacy, for example. And that's something I touched on in a show, is just the horrible dysgenic effect of throughout the ages of the smartest Europeans being priests and nuns, not having children and passing on their genes. All right, here. Church and state. Political interference from the clergy was not tolerated. Hitler stated, quote, if one allows the church to exercise the slightest influence on the governing of the people and the upbringing of the younger generation, it will strive to become omnipotent. And one makes a great mistake if one thinks that one can make a collaborator of the church by accepting compromise. From the earliest days of the regime, the Nazis had come into conflict with the churches. The 1933 sterilization law of the congenitally retarded was particularly offensive to the Catholic Church, because, you know, they have that doctrine that all life is sacred. With its doctrine of the sanctity of all human life, in contradistinction to the eugenic outlook of Nazis. In 1937, Pius XI accused the regime of, quote, secret and open fundamental hostility to Christ and his church. Towards the end, in 1945, Pope Pius XII described National Socialism as, quote, the arrogant apostasy from Jesus Christ, the denial of his doctrine and of his work of redemption, the cult of violence, the idolatry of race and blood, the overthrow of human liberty and dignity. That's from the Pope. One point of irritation to Hitler was that the church, while the churches had declared themselves enemies of the German state, the people were expected to subsidize them. Subsidies were actually extracted from the wage packet, much like union levies. In contrast, contract out meant to endure considerable antagonism. This paradox was never resolved. Hitler commented that, quote, once we cease handling out millions of marks a year to the church, the damn parsons will very quickly change their tune. And instead of having the impudence to revile us and to attack us in the most shameful manner, we'll very soon be eating out of our hands. Once the war is over, I will put a swift end to the concordat, C-O-N-C-O-D-A-T, that's a diplomatic agreement between the state and the Vatican. It will give me the greatest personal pleasure to point out to the church all those occasions on which it has broken the terms of it. One need only recall the close cooperation between the church and the murderers of Heydrich, the security chief. Catholic priests not only allowed them to hide in a church, but he allowed them to entrench themselves in the sanctuary of the altar. And it kind of reminds me of all the, you know, stuff they did with the Jews, helping the Jews. But, you know, on the other side of that, of course, the church did help a lot of the Nazis flee to Argentina. So there's always both sides of any issue, I guess. But he goes on, I don't interfere with the matters of belief. Therefore, I can't help churchmen interfere with temporal affairs. The organized lie must be smashed. The state must remain the absolute master. And then here is another quote. When I was younger, I thought it was necessary to set about matters with dynamite. I've since recognized there's room for a little subtlety. The rotten branch falls of itself. The final state must be in St. Peter's chair, a senile officiant. Facing him, a few old women, as gaga and as poor in spirit as anyone could be. The young and healthy are on our side. Against a church that identifies itself with the state, as in England, I have nothing to say, but even so, it's impossible to, and I don't know where that goes, because as I said, they kind of screwed up the copying of this, but let's see where we were. Okay, these are kind of like just a bunch of quotes anyway, so let me move on here, because there's only one more. Amongst his trusted aides, he referred to this god as Uralten, the original or ancient one, an old Germanic conception. Speaking of that, I have a copy of the Ur book, which speaks to that. And, you know, I don't know if I'm going to get to it tonight. Maybe I'll read that tonight after this, because that really is an interesting document. And when I was talking with Kyle and I went to the Greek church and I mentioned that we did the circle dance, you know, the circle dance is a very kind of pagan, heathen, even satanic, thing. It's very, has roots that go back to ancient times. So maybe I'll read that after this. But anyway, Christianity had placed women in a position of subjection to enforce their destruction. Priesthood was seen as a homoerotic, even homosexual institution, anti-women by nature. Quote, the whole tenor of the priesthood and the whole of Christianity was that of an erotic male fraternity for the formation and maintenance of this Bolshevism. I have the conviction that the Roman emperors who exterminated the first Christians did precisely what we are doing with the communists. These Christians were at the time the vilest scum which the city accommodated, the vilest Jewish people, the vilest Bolsheviks they were. The Bolshevism at that time had the power to grow large on the dying body of Rome. The priesthood of this Christian church, which later in unending battle subjugated the Arian church, was engaged from the 4th to the 5th century in demanding the celibacy of the priesthood. They based themselves on St. Paul and the original apostles, who presented the woman as something sinful and tolerated or recommended marriage as a legal way out of whoredom, that is, in the Bible, and represented the procreation of children as, quote, necessary evil. This priesthood pursued this path consistently through those centuries until in the year 1139 the celibacy of priests was put into effect. Quote, further, I have the conviction that merely for the few who did not wish to reconcile themselves to this homosexuality, especially for the parish priests who, in my estimation, are to an overwhelming extent over 50% not homosexual, while I assume that in the monasteries, homosexuality amounts to 90 to 95 or 100% homosexual. This is a way out created for them to procure the necessary women and females in the oral confession box. I don't know. Okay. Himmler hoped that within a few years, judicial proceedings would show the church leadership up as a homosexual fraternity, which, quote, had been terrorizing people for 1,800 years, claiming from them the greatest blood sacrifices, sadistically perverse in its manifestation. And, you know, it's funny. I, as a side note, I find it a little ironic because the SS, I think, modeled itself after the... Who was it? The during the Inquisition, the Saint Ignatius Loyola, you know, the Jesuits. That's it, the Jesuits. So that's kind of ironic. But quote, yeah, so he says, let's see, has been terrorizing people for 1800 years, claiming from them the greatest blood sacrifice is sadistically perverse in its manifestations. As we have seen, several years later, the judicial system did begin to address this matter with the trial of monks for molestation. Himmler emphasized, so I guess they had the same problem back then as they still do today. Himmler emphasized the anti-woman nature of the medieval witch and heresy trials. It is an interesting sidelight that he expected particular attention to be paid to interaction between his SS men and young women socially to combat the exaggerated masculinizing of society. Addressed the SS at Posen in 1942 on their numerous tasks, Himmler zeroed in on Christianity, saying that it would have to be dealt with more vigorously than hitherto. This Christendom, this greatest pestilence which could have befallen us in history, which has weakened us for every conflict, we must finish with. Himmler attacked the Christian idea of man as above or apart from nature and explained his cyclic conception of eternity, that man must be anchored in his ancestors and in his grandchildren. You know, Kerry Bolton, he would be a great guy to interview, the guy that wrote this. I might try and reach out to him, but I haven't had luck with my interviews, as you see, tonight. But, yeah. Any comments? I know you're on the line there this whole time. I feel like, I don't want to be rude and just keep reading while I got you there. Do you mind listening, or did you... you find this interesting at all? I mean, because this is something that comes up a lot, is National Socialism, and, it's whether it was pro-Christian or anti-Christian. And Dave actually just sent me a link not too long ago on a new book that came out, that talks about this. Let me try and bring that one up here. But, Damon, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, I mean, is it okay?
Yeah.
Now you can't listen to the show. You have to call in, right, to listen.
That's right.
Okay. All right. So, I just wanted to make sure you're all right there. Okay. Let me move on here. Martin Bormann on Christianity. Martin Bormann, who became Hitler's secretary and deputy after Hess's abortive peace mission into England. Like Himmler, Rosenberg, Heydrich, Hitler, and most of the others at the top of the Reich hierarchy, also had a clear perspective on Christianity. The following is taken from Kirchliches Jahrbuch für die Evangelische Kirche in Deutschland. Okay, I don't know what the National Socialist and Christian concepts are incompatible. The Christian churches build upon the ignorance of the men and strive to keep large portions of the people in ignorance, because only in this way can the Christian churches maintain their power. On the other hand, National Socialism is based on scientific foundations. Christianity's immutable principles, which were laid down almost 2,000 years ago by Jews, have increasingly stiffened into life-alien dogmas. National Socialism, however, if it wants to fulfill its task further, must always guide itself according to the newest data of scientific researchers. Quote, when in the future our youth no longer hear anything about this Christianity, whose doctrine is far below our own, Christianity will automatically disappear. When we National Socialists speak of God, by God we do not understand, as do naive Christians and their clerical beneficiaries, a man-like being who is sitting around in some corner of the spheres. Rather, we must open the eyes of mankind to the fact that, in addition to our unimportant Earth, there exist countless other bodies in the universe, many of them surrounded, like the sun, by smaller bodies, the moons. The force which moves all those bodies in the universe, in accordance with natural law, is what we call the eternal, the All-Father, or God. The assertion that this world force can worry about the fate of every individual, every bacillus on earth, and that it can be influenced by so-called prayer or other astonishing things is based either on a suitable dose of naivety or outright commercial effrontery. Now, I don't know. I think there is something to say for the power of, not the power of prayer, but the power of meditation and focusing your will. You know, I think that, you know, things can happen. But, yeah, I'll just go on. In contrast, we National Socialists call upon ourselves to live as naturally as possible. That is, in keeping with the laws of life. The more thoroughly we know and attend to the laws of nature and life, the more we can adhere to them, the more do we correspond to the will of the eternal. The deeper our insight into the will of the eternal, the greater will be our success. It follows from the incompatibility of National Socialism and Christian concepts that we must oppose any strengthening of existing Christian denominations and must refuse to give them any assistance. We can make no differentiation between the various Christian confessions. Any strengthening of the Christian concepts would merely work against us. To an ever-increasing degree, the folk must be wrested from Christianity and their agents, from the pastors. Obviously, the Christians, from their standpoint, will and must defend themselves against their power of loss. But never again must Christianity regain an influence in the leadership of our folk. This must absolutely and finally be broken. And here is the last section, Christianity and the Third Reich. Despite the pragmatic and relatively cautious approach the times required, the regime did begin preliminary measures against Christianity. One means was to heathenize the churches from within. A Nazified German Christian faith movement was formed in opposition to the mainline Protestant churches. Hundreds of pastors of the confessional church were arrested in 1937. Catholics were removed from the civil service. In 1937, over 100,000 Germans formally left the Catholic Church. According to the reliable British historian David Irving in The War Path, the Nazis, quote, the Nazis discouraged Catholic education in schools, the convents and monasteries were dissolved, and their property confiscated, and the Jesuits were driven out of influence everywhere. The Hitler Youth sung such verses as, quote, I am neither Christian nor Catholic. I am for the SA through thick and thin. Something of what the regime had in mind for eventually replacing Christianity with after the war can be deduced from the proposals drawn up in 1942 for the creation of a National Reich Church by leading National Socialist philosopher Alfred Rosenberg. Wow, that would have been awesome, man. You know, when I think of all the things that they were going to do had they won the war, it just really makes me depressed. But anyway, let's see. Indeed, his own magnum opus, The Myth of the 20th Century, had met such condemnation by the churches since its first publication in 1930. Among the points for a Reich Church were, number 13, the National Church demands immediate cessation of the publishing and dissemination of the Bible in Germany. Point 14, the Führer's Mein Kampf is greatest of all documents, embodies the purest and truest ethics for the present and future life of our nation. Point 18, the National Church will clear away from its altars all crucifixes, Bibles, and pictures of the saints. Point 19, on the altars there must be nothing but Mein Kampf, and to the left on the altar a sword. Point 30, on the day of its foundation, the Christian cross must be removed from all churches, cathedrals, and chapels, and it must be superseded by the swastika. The priesthoods were to be replaced by orators. And, you know, the references here are David Irving's The War Path from 1978, William Shirer, Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which, of course, obviously is a anti-Nazi book, but doesn't mean the information isn't factual. Hitler's Secret Conversations, 1941-44. Hermann Rauschning, Hitler Speaks. And Peter Padfield, Himmler, Reichsführer, SS, Macmillan Press, London, 1991. So that's the references. I don't know who wrote Hitler's Secret Conversations. It doesn't seem to have the author there. But, you know, again, I just say, like, there's plenty of evidence to show that National Socialism was going to become its own religion. And it already did. It really provided a alternative spiritual, path for the people of Europe. And that's why, because it was smashed, it was, we're in all the trouble that we're in today. But, Damon, we only have a little time left. I figured I would ask you, how in black metal you have this real focus towards attacking Christianity, yet they don't really come out and attack Judaism all that much. Now, that really does kind of bother me a little bit. Other than like National Socialist black metal, you won't really find that much going against Judaism as well. And, even Islam or all the Abrahamic religions. But, maybe it's a good thing because maybe, there's so much that's against Judaism within the quote unquote movement on the internet. And very few people really attack the enabler of Judaism. So maybe it's a good thing. The idea is if we free ourselves from this, we can free ourselves from the greater poison of what our enemies have put over us. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I've noticed that too. There's only a few. I mean, one of them that's on Moribund Cult Records is Grand Belial's Key. They go after the Jews as well as Christianity. But, yeah, I mean, overwhelmingly, most of them don't. They just probably grew up in religion and now they are totally against it. And, I watched a documentary. It's a 3-disc set called The Cult History of the Third Reich.
But, yeah, I got a copy of that. There's a few different versions of that. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I wasn't really sure on that because, I don't really like to read books and I'm not really into history, but I was like, well, that's interesting. That kind of makes some of these organizations or groups or identity kind of feel uncomfortable that they're not, in line with the people that they look up to in history. They're, against it. I know they put their twist on everything. I also want to go through a few things in the, current news here.
Yeah, go ahead, man. Go ahead.
Yeah, real quick. The Golden Dawn, I was looking at some things that they post on some sites like Truth Militia. They're, keeping score of how they're doing in the rankings. And, they've been moving up the charts, and now they're at a close second in Greece. And I was like, well, America, they're always talking about how their democracy and they're spreading democracy around the world. In Greece, they got over a dozen parties, to choose from. So in America, we got two or three. What's the major two, of course, are controlled by the same Jews. So we only have actually one party, but they give that presentation like the rest of the world like that, and we're the only ones that have choice in leadership.
Yeah, that's a good point, man. That's a good point.
Another thing, on public radio, they have this commercial the conservatives got going around. I don't know if it's it's obviously one of the organizations. I didn't catch what it was, like the Council Concerned Citizens or something, I guess. And they're really proud of their message of, conservatives and Republican Party are pushing for some law where illegal Mexicans are going to have to learn English and wait 10 years to be a citizen and pay fines. And I'm thinking, the money that they're going to pay the fines out of is the money that they already received from the government. So they're just going to give some of the taxpayers' money back in return.
Right, yeah.
say that they were fined. So, and something that a lot of conservatives probably don't know about their god, Ronald Reagan, is he was the first president to grant amnesty in the 80s to over 3 million illegal Mexicans. And then the government promised that that would never happen again, and it has happened a few times since then. So if they say, and now it's going to be 10 times as many, at least 30 million, and then they're going to promise, oh, well, this is it, you know, no more amnesty, but yet they'll still do it again. It may be twice that again.
This country is finished. I mean, that's why if you're a race nationalist, you cannot hold on to Americanism, to this idea. We have to become as radical anti-American as we possibly can, because it's killing our race, and it's something that, you know, what happens here is going to be really interesting, I'll tell you. But, you know, Europe is a different story. You can still kind of be a European nationalist for your own particular country. Over here, your nation is your race. Your skin is your uniform, as George Lincoln Rockwell stated. So,
and the final thing that's caught my attention in the current news is about the NSA, the National Security Agency. You know, snooping and tapping into your email or phone lines and such, which they've always done for, yeah, I'm sure, decades. Anyway, most people don't have anything to worry about. I mean, that would be a really boring job to listen into all the nonsense conversations that the typical American has. I mean, it's not like everybody's out there conspiring and onto the government or something with really top secret stuff going across the airwaves or something. And it's a logistics.
If they listen to Renegade, I'm sure they'll have some interesting data to work with. But you're right, man. That's hilarious, actually. Your average... Just think of your average American on the phone and what they're talking about, you know, sports or, you know, basketball or freaking going with the new shoe they're going to buy at the mall or whatever it is, you know. Or their soap operas, you know. I mean, Jesus. But,
yeah, so it's nonsense for most people to really be worried about that.
Go ahead.
what was I gonna say? yeah, so, you know, everybody's worried about their communication being tapped into.
Well, they got that big the NSA moved a huge. They got this big facility out in Utah, I think, and they're. You know, they have like terabytes of information, or there's even a bigger term of I forget what it was called, but there's a word for the amount of data that they have over there. I forget. It was cool, but I'll think of it later. Yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, the revolutionary mood is just not here yet for the average masses, but it's still starting to. It's starting to hit home as people lose their jobs and have further insecurity, you know, and, you know, the government expands and, you know, the idea that we're going to become a socialist state with all these minorities and other races that are going to really obtain services through taxes, you know, so... You know, you'll probably have more and more people moving to the right, and, you know, it's just going to be a numbers game where the whites are going to find themselves outnumbered, and they can no longer use the Republican Party or their traditional controlled opposition to obtain any effective resistance against this. So then people are going to have to start thinking, all right, well, what is the alternative to this? And it's going to be secession and pulling away from the system completely and withdrawing and forming your own community. So that's something we're going to have to work on. But yeah, we only got three minutes left of the stream. Did you have anything else you wanted to say? I would go into overtime, but I don't know. I'm kind of I'm disappointed. I didn't have the person I was going to interview, so I kind of lost the energy to keep going. But yeah, go ahead if you wanted to close it out with something, and then I'll just play a track.
I was just going to add on to that. It'd be a logistics nightmare for the NSA to actually listen in to everybody. I mean, we got over 300 million people in this country. So, I mean, they can't really spend that much personal time with everybody. I mean, they have to assign, a person to each household or something. I don't think they can really do that. And I also wanted to say, Flag Day's coming up. And then on the heels of that, the 4th of July, and I would just like to say, fuck America. This is not what people think it is. And, you don't have it loaded up, but, Blue Eyed Devils has a great song called Flag Waver.
Yeah, I'll try and look that one up and maybe play it on the show sometime. All right, Damon, thanks for keeping me company tonight and getting me through. I read a couple things that I thought were pertinent, and we'll be on here next week for another edition of Imperium Europa Treat. Please listen to all the Renegade hosts here. They all do an excellent job. And we are on Metapedia, I saw Kyle brought up to my attention. So that's pretty cool, too. They bring us up over there. So that's it. Here is Amorphis with Black Winter Day. It's not going to play the entire song. It'll cut out. And we will see you again. Thanks a lot. I'll talk to you later, Damon. Thanks for the call.
See you at the round table. Later.
All right, brother. Yep. Take care. I just looked it up. It was Iota Bites. That's what I was thinking of. And apparently there's even bigger categories like Brontobite and Geobite. So that was that. All right, guys, I'm going to head out of here. And, you know, we'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. I didn't check out the chat tonight, but I will be with you on the round table on Saturday. And we'll see you then. Take care. So then, this is Dane Antiques signing out.